Welcome to the final panel session of Mumbrella 360. Now, not only do we have the audience here at the Hilton Hotel here in Sydney, you may also be listening to this on this week's Mumbrella podcast. If you don't already subscribe, then please do find the Mumbrella Cast on iTunes. And finally, we're also live streaming this to the homepage of Mumbrella as well. So you may not actually be in the room with us. You might be watching this on video. So welcome along if you are. I'll now ask our panel to come and join us on stage, or if you'd like to all come up together. Joining us are Mark Buckman, Chief Marketing Officer of Telstra, John Steadman, Chairman of Group M, Joe Pollard, CEO of 9MSN, and Anthony Friedman, CEO of Host and Chairman of the Communications Council. So, we have marketers and media agencies and media owners, and of course, the creative agencies representing us today. So we'll go first, straight away to the first question, which comes from me, and I'm going to throw this one to you, Joe, to start off with, I think, which is...
Lucky you.
What have you learned this year?
What have I learned this year? I think this year, more than any, the rate of change in the media industry that we're going through is probably more rapid than the last couple of years. Normally when you sit down, we sit down to do our strategic plan, you'll have three or four things that you're juggling. We've just come out of our strategic planning process and there's probably seven or eight. Things like ad exchanges, rise of mobility, it's all about social. So it just feels like the change is more rapid than it ever has been.
And on to you, Anthony.
Sort of along the similar lines.
Perhaps just a little closer to the microphone as well.
I think what I've seen more than anything else this year is the fact that the world order, or the new world order of brands, continues to change very radically and very quickly. I think we've all heard lots of conversations about Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. We've also talked endlessly about the fact that a company that didn't exist 15 years ago until last month was the world's most valuable brand. We've talked about things like the demise of some of the biggest corporations in the world, like General Motors. But I think, again, you see this writ large with group shopping this year. I mean, a category that didn't exist 2 years ago now has 400 or 500 replicas of Groupon. Groupon, a company that's now worth $6 billion, a company that is on record as being the fastest company in history to reach $1 billion in sales, is recession-proof, arguably may have even come from the economic climate. I think it just indicates how that reshuffling and reordering of global brands and the hierarchy of them is still very much in flux.
And Steady, what have you learned this year?
I think what I've learned is if you invest in good talent, it pays return. And it certainly has for our group. And frankly, clients are willing to pay for it, for good talent, if you've got it. And as I said, it's really paid off in our company throughout the course of 2010 and into 2011.
And Mark, lots to learn
in
a new
same
job.
Camp as John, and now there's never been a more important time to have more of the better people working with you. And from that perspective, you hire slowly and fire fast to make sure that you've got the right talent working with you, and it'll give you better results. There's no doubt about that. And I guess on a personal level, I've learnt that if I'm a balanced individual, then I'm going to deliver better results myself. And it's not all about putting in the 18-hour days. It's putting in quality time to make sure that you get quality results.
Can I ask you a question, Mark?
Sure.
Are you willing to pay agencies good money for the talent that they offer?
Well, I hope our agencies that are here today would say that we do. And certainly, you know, I've been at Telstra for 2 months, so 2 months last Friday, and I bring with me, I think, the last 6 years working at CBA with that principle in mind, and I definitely hope that BMF, Goodby Silverstein and Icon, as my principal agencies there, would have said that we did. I absolutely believe that if you want the best quality, you need to pay for it, and if you get the best quality, you'll get the best results.
Good answer.
With more than 94.5 million active users globally, eBay is the world's largest online marketplace,
Visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
I don't know if it's too early to turn to the audience yet, but we'll certainly give it a go. I see a hand there towards the back, and if you wouldn't mind standing up and letting us know who you are and where you're from, please.
Hi, it's Matt from Dialogics. Interested in hearing what's the best mistake you've ever made in marketing, and what did you learn from it?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Let me just repeat it. What's the best mistake you've made in marketing, what did you learn from it? I think we'll start at the opposite end of the panel this time. So I throw that one to you first, Mark.
Thanks, Tim.
You had the expression that was thinking that, I could tell.
Yeah, look, I think the biggest mistake that people can make is not taking the risk to do something bold and brave. I've certainly been guilty of that in the past, and I hope that I've learnt from that mistake. And I hope that the work that I did while I was at CBA demonstrated the fact that, you know, the bigger the mission that you have, the bigger the risk that you actually have to take. And I think that there are too many times when people aren't prepared to do that and aren't prepared to take the risk that's needed to actually get something big done. So that's what I'd probably, how I'd answer that.
Steady.
I think probably the biggest mistake I made was that I retired. What I learned from it, I came back.
My biggest mistake was probably thinking that I could go overseas for 2 years and ended up staying overseas for 16. So when Steady actually wanted me to go to Hong Kong, and I was like, okay, well, I'll go, thinking it was a big mistake because of the career I was leaving behind in Sydney. And it's turned out to be the best thing I ever did. So I think that's probably from... I know it didn't answer your question from a marketing perspective. There's too many mistakes I've made in marketing to actually do it on a panel, but... but, yeah, I think that's probably the best way to answer that.
And Anthony?
I think I don't know if it's the best mistake, but certainly a mistake that I'd learned a valuable lesson from is the idea of doing things because of the financial opportunity that it might present. I think that the opportunity to, for example, in an agency environment, take on a client that you don't necessarily feel is a good cultural fit because they have a lot of money to spend, is probably something that you will come to regret over time. If not only for the reason that once you have that client and you have that revenue that you're reliant on and a team that you have recruited to work on that client, it becomes a lot more difficult to part ways with them because of a point of principle than it would have been to have said no in the first place.
Okay, well, I think at this point I'll cross over to our social media monitoring team, starting off with Robin. Robin, anything want to throw a question into the mix?
Yeah, first question is, what do you see in your respective sectors as the biggest enemy, and how do you intend to fight it?
Okay, we'll start from the opposite end this time. So straight back the ball comes to Anthony. Your biggest enemy, and how are you going to fight it?
This is more difficult than I thought it was going to be. Look, I think that there is definitely a feeling amongst many agencies that the procurement process can start to force agency selection around criteria that should be important but perhaps secondary, that there should be more focus on the quality of the relationship, the creative potential, the overall value that a company might be able to offer, rather than having too much focus on the dollars and cents and, you know, the amount of margin that you can squeeze out of that agency. And I suppose, you know, coming back to John's point earlier, the remunerative elements, and I suppose the contractual benefits that you can gain over a client, over an agency. Sorry,
and Joe.
I think the biggest enemy in our space is talent, the lack of experienced talent. And so then what happens is that you push people into positions and jobs ahead of their time, and it ends up ending badly for the business and for the person. So, and particularly in the digital space, and it's coming from all angles in terms of needing that talent, I think that's our biggest enemy, that we need to stop poaching from each other
and just really commit to generational training of the entire industry. Because what I think is happening is that we're pushing people into managerial positions ahead of their time, and because they're really good at maybe being a functional person or an individual contributor, they end up either burning out or leaving, and we're not really spending the time on those 25 to 30-year-olds and really training them to be really great managers that we're all going to pay for it in 5 or 10 years' time.
John Steadman.
I go with Anthony on this one. I think that our biggest enemy at the moment is procurement, in as much as they're so price-driven and they tend to forget about how strategy is more important in the end, because if you don't get that right, you'll fuck it up anyway. And I think...
Steady, I'm going to have to tick the explicit box on iTunes now.
Oh, sorry.
We're in children's time.
Sorry.
But it means that now I've got to pick it. Now that I've got a ticket, you can say whatever you like for the rest of the panel.
You didn't brief us on this, Tim. And also, the mentality of some clients that treat you as a supplier as opposed to a partner. And having a partnership is far more, works better on both parts as opposed to just being seen as a supplier.
Well, it's as long as you treat your clients as just not an ends to the means of the money, John.
Absolutely agree with that, Mark.
And I'd certainly like to stick up for those people in procurement who do a good job, there are many of them out there. I think you've, as a client marketing organisation, you've got to work with procurement to get the strategic results that you want. They're not all about just trying to milk agencies and save clients money. There are some that work very well. But to answer your question more directly from my perspective is the enemy from my point of view is an over-reliance on research to make decisions. I think that there are way too many people in marketing organisations today that are using research as a crutch, as a pass-fail to determine whether something should work or not, in absence of using their experience and instinct to make decisions for them. And using that research as a pass-fail test instead of making brave decisions and having the courage to back ideas that they think are going to work.
Yeah, if I could just qualify what I said, I don't have an issue with procurement, but I think there's too much emphasis on it, as opposed to saying that they're bad people.
Okay, well, we stay in a related area, which I'm actually going to link a couple of questions, and perhaps you can run at both of these at once. And Mark, I'm going to come to you first. I'd like to ask you two things. What makes a good agency, and what makes a good client?
Let's start with the agency. I mean, I think that agencies who are absolutely prepared to get to know your category and get to know your business and actually feel that they are part of your organisation and have as much at risk in the success or failure of what they do as you do. And I guess that then turns the question on its head, because it actually requires the client to actually feel that of their agency partner. And I'm certainly of the school that they're not suppliers. They're not people that we just pick up the phone and say, do this, do that. It's very much about solving our business problems. And that actually means they need to understand your business, and you need to open the kimono and let them see what the business is and what the issues actually are, rather than saying, here's a communications brief with a prescribed set of outcomes that we want you to deliver work on. So it's being very much a part of the partnership, and I mean that in all senses, not only in terms of the relationship and the outcomes from a work perspective, but also in the way that agencies are remunerated.
And Steady, what makes a good agency? What makes a good client?
A good agency is an agency that has a vision, that is going to take its staff on a journey to a destination, has a process in place, it has the right talent within the organisation, offers diversified services for clients, has a good culture that the people within the organisation can hold on to, has career paths planned for their people, has training, and importantly, has a passion for the client's business. And most importantly, having fun at the same time. That's what I see a media agency as, and I think probably creative agencies as well. In terms of a client willing to pay the right right price for the right services, looks for totally integrated solutions, can put a good brief together, because you get a bad input means bad output, prepared to take risks, and finally, back to the original point I made, having a partnership as opposed to a supplier relationship.
Thanks, Eddie. Now, Joe, you've in the past worked both agency side and client side, so
and publisher side.
Hopefully you can answer that question.
I'm going to answer a good agency brief from agency from both sides. A great agency, and I was lucky enough to have to, when I was on the client side, had to go around the world and find really good agencies. And every single time came down to two things. The agency we ended up awarding the business to, this is when I worked at Nike, passion for your brand and your product. They could do the best presentation in the world, but I can't tell you how many times I walked into a pitch and they were wearing Addy. And you were just like, you guys don't even, you haven't even begun to understand the culture of who we are. So even though we sometimes picked the agency that were second in the polish, because they just were like, we really want to work with these people because they love and understand our brand. And a great agency is someone that has the confidence to walk into a room and call bullshit on their client. Because the amount of times we would have these amazing debates because the agency just thought they had the best idea and that you as a client couldn't see it, you ended up getting through and doing really innovative and breakthrough stuff. So I think a great agency is an agency that has the courage of their convictions and are willing to really not be afraid that the client's going to fire them because their idea and their passion is going to... Because it is hard to deliver innovation. It just doesn't come. So that's from a client side. From an agency, from a publisher side, a great agency is one that treats you as a partner, not as a supplier. And be so the people that you know you're not you have a true partnership with, and they bring you inside, and you're solving the client's problem together. I feel like we can do better work together when you're working in partnership with the agency. When you just sort of throw in a brief, and we sometimes get briefs on instant messenger. We don't even get briefs written in email sometimes.
That's worth just repeating. You sometimes get briefs on instant messenger.
On IM. I can tell you that work isn't going to be very good and the response isn't going to be very good when you get your brief on IM. Yeah. In terms of being a good client is someone that will take joint risks. So when the agency comes in and really wants you to take a leap, that you take the leap together, because there will be failures. And you need to take the failure together, not blame each other. And then I agree with Steady, write a good brief and understand how to give good constructive feedback, particularly to a creative team. There's nothing worse than generic feedback from an agency to a client. And also, too, letting an idea breathe. So not having to worry about all the executional elements of an idea right early in the process. Let the idea breathe and go with it for a while. You'll sort it out where it has to go and how it has to execute, but really nurture the idea first before you kill it through executional needs too early. Sorry, that was a long-winded answer.
No, it was a very good answer. Although I am intrigued that you're saying don't use Instant Messenger. I thought that was part of the Microsoft family.
No, just don't brief me on Instant Messenger. Actually,
Joe,
give me more than
times.
A three-line brief.
You've got to get with the times, Joe.
Huh?
You've got to get with the times.
Oh, yeah.
Use it for almost anything else, but
not writing a brief.
And Anthony, what makes a good agency? What makes a good client?
For me, I think a lot of it comes down to clarity. And if I think about agencies, most agencies are more similar than they are different. And I think a good agency is very clear on who it is and who it works for and the role that it plays for a particular client. And I suppose I'd sort of illustrate the example by saying if you were an agency that was very focused on working with retail brands, for argument's sake, then the way that you might be a good agency, in inverted commas, for your client base is to be able to deliver stuff more quickly or more cost-effectively than they had anticipated. if you were an agency that was very focused on creative innovation, to Joe's point, then your client might be much more likely to give you latitude around how long that takes or how much it costs, because they realise that the real role that agency fulfils is about creative magic. If you flipped those two and you had the client that was looking for the retail solution and they were working with an agency that took ages to do the work and it costs more money than you imagined it was going to be, and it was creatively brilliant but it hadn't really met their expectations, or vice versa, then both of those clients would consider that agency to be a poor performer. But if you are clear on who you are and what you do and the role that you play and the type of client that you're right for, then it means that you attract clients that look for you for the very reasons that you think that you exist as well, and you therefore have a harmonious relationship. If you then translate that into what makes a good client is very clear on the type of agency that they're looking for. They're not out there putting together a list and they say, well, we'll have one that's big and one that's small and one that's multinational and one that's domestic, and therefore we've got all our bases covered with the pitch. They should be asking agencies that are very, very similar to pitch, because they've already determined the kind of agency that they need. I think beyond that, it's about being fair and reasonable around the circumstances that you ask your agency to deliver. By all means, be demanding, but let's also be realistic about what can be achieved from a business perspective, from a time frame perspective, from a budgetary perspective. And I think that those degrees of clarity are the things that generally make good clients and good agencies.
Okay, can I add to that? That's something that didn't come out, but it's somewhat of an add to what Anthony just said. I think you've got to work on both sides as client and agency with each other when you've got a shared vision for what you want to get out of it. And there are many cases when that's just not the case and relationships continue when there isn't a shared vision. But the thing that I think that hasn't come out in the discussion that we've just had is work with people that you want to work with and that you can work with. And you know, I think that there is something as basic as human interaction in this is, are these people that I'm going to be able to work with? And I think it's a really important part of a successful relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I think just if we are allowed to just ad lib a bit, I think the
ad libbing is good.
Certainly in my experience of 20 odd years of doing this, and it comes back to somewhat to what Joe was saying, sometimes an agency will win a pitch because they were kind of as good as everyone else, but the chemistry was great. And I think that that's sort of what you're saying, Mark, that you walk out of a meeting and you are on both sides genuinely inspired about the potential of what you could co-create. And I think that that in many cases can transcend any of the other stuff, because you know, as I said before, agencies are more similar than they are different. They should all be able to be passionate about a brand. They should all be able to understand a category. They should all be able to get there on time and on brief and on budget. But sometimes that X factor can be the difference between feeling that this is a client or a company that you could really do something special with and not. And so the answer is, you know, to the question of what makes a good agency can sometimes be just down to a great potential fit between people on one side of the table and the people on the other.
Well, in a moment we'll take our first question from Twitter. Just a reminder to those who are watching the live stream, a reminder firstly of who you're watching. Mark Buckman is Chief Marketing Officer of Telstra. John Steadman is Chairman of Group M. Joe Pollard is CEO of 9MSN. And Anthony Friedman is CEO of Host and Chairman of the Communications Council. So if you do want to throw in a question via the via social media, via Twitter, then the hashtag is M360. And we'll cross over to Lachlan now to see if you can throw us a question from the Twitter stream. I've watched loads of zipping past on my iPhone, so I hope you've caught one.
Yeah, no, I've got a few here, but I guess the first one I've got here is from Chris Stevenson, who ran the manifesto session yesterday. The world is changing faster than our industry. How can we tackle and overcome inertia in the comms industry?
So the world is moving faster than the industry. How can we tackle that inertia within our industry, which is a media question. Chris Stevenson is the strategy director at PhD, as Lachlan said, ran the Mumbrella Manifesto session yesterday, which you'll, again, if you're watching it on the live stream, then if you open up another window, then you'll find it in the full manifesto in the opinion thread. But as a media question, I guess the logical place to start is probably with you, Steady.
Me? I think innovation. We've got to be continually innovative in what we're doing and bring new thinking to the way we work and the people that we employ.
And on to you, Joe.
I don't think we have inertia in our industry. I really don't. I wake up every day and I've got about 1,000 things to do and I pretty much enjoy all of them. But so I don't... There's a lot of negativity that I think shadows our industry where people... And I just don't feel it. I think one of the things is becoming a CEO, I've learned, is that as a CEO, you really have to nurture the marketing function. Where, because all of my positions have been in, before this one, have been in media and marketing or whatever, is that I think the marketing function needs a lot of support from the business, particularly in Australia, because I've, since coming home, I've realised that a lot of companies think marketing is a cost centre that basically spend as little as you absolutely have to. So I think a lot of the CEOs need to support the marketing departments more than I think they get it. I think there's too much of them having to justify their existence and justify the idea, and so consequently maybe procurement goes a little too far or you research an idea too much because everyone's defending things. So I think if you allow your marketing department a little bit more latitude, but I don't think we have it.
And Anthony, just a recap of the question. The world is changing faster than our industry. How can we tackle and overcome inertia in the communications industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm inclined to agree with Joe. I mean, inertia suggests that we're trying not to keep pace. I mean, if the question really is the world is changing more quickly than we have ever seen before and we're at risk of falling behind, then I think the simple answer is invest more time and energy in trying to keep pace with the pace of change, and I think that look, perhaps there's a degree of truth in the suggestion that agencies for a period of time have a tendency to stick to the output that they have most delivered and that they're most comfortable with, and I think that we would have seen
30-second TV ads.
Well, potentially. I mean, I think that, you could simplify it down to TV and newspaper ads and posters. But I think that there was a long period during which many agencies that had been around for a long time resisted or didn't necessarily get heavily invested in the digital capability. And as a consequence of that, agencies that specialised only in that came to emerge, and over a period of time I think that advertising agencies realised that digital shouldn't be any different to any other media channel and it should be absolutely part of their competency. So look, perhaps there is an element of truth in people sticking to the stuff that they know best and hoping that the other stuff might go away, but certainly my immediate response would be to simply say stay abreast of what the changes are and work hard to try and keep pace with them.
And Mark Buckman, I saw you nodding fairly enthusiastically at a couple of those points.
No, I don't think it's as serious as perhaps what the question was in terms of it being a disease of inertia. But I think it's up to leadership of companies, both agencies and clients alike, to not tolerate it if it's there. I think partly human nature almost forces people to take simple things and try and make them complex. And we've got to try and keep complexity, remove as much complexity as possible. And there's certainly a tendency to do that. But, I agree with Anthony and Annie in terms of, continuing to push the boundaries and looking for new things and what Steady said in terms of innovation. So it's, continue to push the boundaries, go and learn a lot more. I think that a lot of what we've got to learn from an Australian perspective isn't going to be learnt here. It's actually going to be learnt by looking to both Europe and the United States for what's happening ahead of the curve. But it's up to everybody in this room and everybody in client and agency organisations to make sure that you're doing that. But I don't think that it is as prevalent as perhaps the question suggested.
Okay, thank you for that. We'll take another question from the room. The first hand I saw was with a microphone right there. If you could tell us who you are and where you're from, please.
Paddy Dream. I've just noticed that the three men on the panel have man in their name. And the only lady whose name is called Joe. Anyway, my question to each of the panellists, what is the most single important metric by which you judge business success and personal success?
So the single most important metric to judge business and personal success. Let's start with Anthony for this one, if we can, please.
Yeah. Point of clarity, when you talk about business success, do you mean personally or on behalf of clients?
And for the audience at home, the microphone, please.
Your business is Host.
Yes. How do we determine...
What is your single most important metric that defines the success of Host in your mind?
Look, I think it would be difficult to distill that down to just one single metric, because clearly we need to be doing well on a number of fronts. We absolutely need to be a financially viable business. But if I was forced to pick one thing, then it's absolutely the work. We are defined by the work we produce. It is the main output of our existence, and it's the single most important thing that we can deliver to a client to achieve what's most important to them, which is the business return on that investment. So it's first and foremost about the work. From a personal perspective, I think I probably would say that the people component of the business is incredibly important. I think that seeing a group of people that actually enjoy going to work, for the most part, that enjoy the people around them, that are inspired, that are progressing, that have started at point A and over a period of time under your care and supervision get to point B, C or D, is a very personally fulfilling experience. So that's been my response.
And Joe?
I have a very simple mantra, which is say what you're going to do and do it, and then you get left alone to do some other things that you want to do. So, you know, when you're standing up and you're presenting what you're going to do as a business to your board and you commit to it, is make sure you deliver that. And whether or not that is revenue growth year on year or EBIT or whatever it is, and then you get left alone and you get to run your business the way you want to do it and you get the latitude you need. So say you're going to do it and then make sure you do it, I would say, just as a general mantra. Because if you literally aren't going to be able to do it, have the fight then. I think too many people sign up for undoable KPIs because there's either pressure or whatever, and then end up not delivering and you're going to get killed anyway. Personally, I try not to have 3 days in a row driving to work where I don't love what I do. So if I finish a week or 3 days and I'm like, oh, I don't want to drive to work today, it's time for a change. So I just think in general, you just got to love what you do professionally, because you spend enough time away from the people that you love, and you know that you have to love it.
So. And you have announced that you yourself are about to make a change. Do you still love what you do?
Yeah. I love what I do. I just love my 11-year-old and my 9-year-old little boys more at the moment. So, and I'm going to love what I do and spending time with them. So that was a decision I made. I had more than 3 days in a row where I wasn't loving what I was doing versus spending time with them. So.
And steady, the most important metric for business success or personal success?
Well, actually, the business plan I put together for Worldwide for 2011, the title was People, Product and Profit. And you get the people and the product right, the profit comes automatically. I don't worry about the financials, although WPP do, of course. But I know that if I've got those two elements right up front, the third one just comes along with it. And I think I've proved myself right.
And Mark?
Somewhat surprised that my colleagues up here didn't mention customer satisfaction of their clients, but that's certainly the thing that makes a difference for us. Customer satisfaction means that we have happier customers who are going to be prepared to give us more of their business, which means that they'll tell more of their friends about the services that they get from us, which means we'll deliver better results for our shareholders. So there's no doubt about it in my mind that the most important thing from a business point of view is driving customer satisfaction. Simply the same thing applied when I was in the banking world. From a personal perspective, and it's somewhat professionally related, is, you know, I want to make sure that I leave the business that I lead in better shape than when I was given it. And that will be a metric of success for me, is this now in better shape than when I was handed it.
Now, speaking of customer satisfaction, I think as the people in the room have paid $1,600 to be here, they should get the priority for another question or two before we go back to Twitter. Anybody else would like to come in with anything? Show me. I'm not sure if that was just a twitch or whether it was a hand. There's a hand down there. If you wouldn't mind telling us who you are and where you're from, please.
Kathy McGinn, Mindshare. My question is, if you could fast forward 10 years to 2021, what's the biggest change to the industry?
So fast forward 10 years, what's the biggest change we'll see? Joe, I think you've had the opportunity of being over in the US and doing a bit of future gazing recently, so I think perhaps we'll throw that one to you and hopefully something you maybe picked up on that trip.
It's hard. Depends if anti-siphoning still stays in... I think the single biggest change, it'll be in the digital space. And I think it will be more sight, sound and motion and entertainment delivered in a less linear way. So that whole concept of I broadcast something and then I associate myself or my brand and I insert it into whatever piece of content, I think won't be as important in 10 years' time. So I think the concept of just linear sight, sound and motion watching will be not where it is today. And that'll mean money gets invested in a lot of other places and change that will come with that.
And on to you, Anthony.
look, I think it's a... Not to dismiss the question, but I think it's almost impossible to predict what will be the single biggest change in 10 years. If we look back 10 years, to kind of go back to where I started, there are so many things that no one could have ever have predicted. So I might choose to answer it slightly differently. I think that one thing that won't change in 10 years from an agency perspective is the importance of ideas. I think that the single most important thing for an agency, apart from client satisfaction, of course, is the ideas that they create. And that should be able to transcend any change in the media landscape or in the change in, or change in relation to media consumption. The context of the way the idea is applied might change, and the way that people engage with it or participate or share might change, but ultimately there will be certain things that remain constant. And beyond that, I think it will be difficult to with any real insight, say this is what I think it will be like then.
And Steady, I'll come next to you for that question, the 10 years in the future question.
Good God. I know one thing, I'll be retired and living in Bali.
But will you change your mind again?
Oh, I don't think so, not 10 years down the track. Look, to Anthony's point, if you went back 10 years, there's no way in the world you could have predicted what we're experiencing now in terms of technology. To forecast what's going to happen in 10 years' time is very difficult, but I think one thing that will definitely be the case, it will be addressable media. And that, by that I mean that you'll be talking to consumers that are interested only in your product. You'll be able to talk to them, give them more details about your product. People that just have cats, for example, you'll be able to send messages directly to them on cat food and so on. So it's going to be far more targeted media.
Mark Batman.
Yeah, look, I'm in the same camp. I remember in 1990 and I was working at McCann in New York and I was asked to go to Japan and give a speech to a group of media executives or the media industry about media at the millennium, and they asked for our predictions on what would happen. And I had a super genius boss at the time who had a presentation that was called The Isoquantic Age, Media at the Millennium. and he predicted that the electromagnetic spectrum would be broken up and that everything that went by land would go by air and everything by air would go by land. And he actually turned out to be reasonably right, but in the meantime there were 2 dot-com crashes along the way and everybody thought the world had come to an end. So I'm not in any position to predict what's going to happen in 10 years' time. I might call on my friend Ira Carlin, who made those bold predictions back then. but just excited by the fact that things continue to change at the rate that they do. And you know, when you think that, you know, in the banking sector as an example, that in the next not too far away, that your mobile phone is going to be, you know, the device that you use as your transaction device. Instead of carrying credit cards or cash around, you know, those things I think are incredibly exciting, and the way we live our lives is going to change.
We'll now go to our human dashboard that is our social media monitoring team, and I'll turn to Robin Hicks, Deputy Editor of Mumbrella.
Right, yeah, a question from Chris Walton at Quantium. How able do you feel our industry is at understanding the true effectiveness of what we do? And what do you think can be done to improve understanding in this area?
So understanding true effectiveness, that sounds like if ever there was a client question.
Yeah, I think we've come a long way. Mm. And Chris and the Quantium guys have done a lot to help in this regard. You know, a lot of the econometric modelling that they do certainly takes a lot less of the guesswork out of what marketers and agencies have to do. Yeah, I think that there's a lot less that we now rely on, you know, the past and can really look at real data to help inform decisions. And that's very different from the comment that I made earlier about relying on research to make decisions for you. I'm talking about really looking at data and looking for patterns and looking for analysis that can help us make decisions. So a lot less of it is now gut feel versus, you know, being able to really scientifically get to an answer.
John Steadman, yeah. True effectiveness.
Yeah, I agree with Mark. Data is the new black, and you know, we're using a lot more to forecast sales and future trends, not only for clients, businesses, but also for the media owners in terms of where we believe the spend is going to be in the next 6 months, next 12 months, based on trends. So. Data is definitely a major player in our business these days and in the future.
Jo?
I think in any effectiveness conversation, you just have to balance the qual with the quant. And I think in a world where we are going to get more and more data and it's going to be able to tell us more and more things, I worry that in the marketing space, that gets overridden by... qual stuff.
Just doing a Wayne Swan there.
Yeah. goes by the by. If I look at some of the qualitative decisions that we made in the Nike marketing department, that if any piece of quantitative data would have come across people's desks, 80% of what we would have done, we wouldn't have done. So I just... it isn't. There is a science, but there's also secret sauce. And I just hope in the future world that we don't lose sight that we need a blend, because some of those really important nuggets that sit out on the side will be ignored if all we do is look through a quant lens. And I think there is an over-reliance on that in our industry at the moment, even though it's going to be very, very important.
And Anthony, with your Communications Council hat on, obviously the effectiveness awards have been... rising up in the agenda.
Yeah, look, I think that the effectiveness awards are incredibly important because they allow agencies to demonstrate that clients are going to be most likely to measure them or their success by. So that's fine. Look, I think that if the measure of effectiveness is applied in the context of looking at how a campaign that has been completed and is in market has performed, then my opinion would be that data is the key to unlocking that. Being able to collate more data more accurately and to be able to interpret that in more detail surely will give us a better understanding of how the work that we have in market performs. Interestingly, if you are talking about effectiveness in the context that Joe is, as in predicting the likely effectiveness of something that has yet to be put into market, then I would say the complete opposite. Mm. Data is the last thing that you would want to try and use to do that. I think in that instance, what you need to do is very much use research as an information tool, and then coming back to something that Mark said, and then make a good judgment based on your experience and perhaps subjectivity, but that's what people pay you for, you know, your expertise, experience and point of view. And like Joe, I think that if I look back over the years of host, some of the things that we have done that have unquestionably been the most successful are things that would never have been able to have come to market had we tried to research them in advance, because the ways that we would research were far too blunt for people to have ever envisaged what we would finally be able to create.
Yeah, a great example of that is MasterCard. I mean, I think that it's probably one of the great campaigns of the last decade, the priceless proposition. And when that was developed for MasterCard, again, out of McCann, New York, the data actually said it wasn't going to work. So, you know, that was absolutely instinct of the people working on the team at the time that prevailed over the data. I think it's a balance.
Another question from me, and I'm going to come back to Mark for the first answer as well. The last 12 months have seen a number of dramas involving staff's personal behaviour on social media being linked to brands or to agencies. Recently in the headlines, there was an incident involving GPY&R, but this also came up as a topic in the advertising ethics session earlier on today. When does personal become professional in social media, Mark?
I don't think there's any line, any boundary between the two. You know, when I'm writing on Facebook, which I do every day, I'm often making remarks about new products and services that Telstra are taking to market. And you know, I think one of the things with social media and Best Buy out of the US has probably been a good demonstration of this, where one of their staff members actually wrote an open letter about, certainly wrote a comment in Facebook about the fact that they weren't being paid properly and had a real crack at their CEO for you know the pay policy of the organisation. And the CEO of the company actually got back on Facebook and responded to that staff member in there. And as it turned out, I mean, it's ended up self-moderating to the point that and I think that's what will ultimately happen, is that it becomes a self-moderating environment where people know come across what the boundaries are themselves, without you having to really impose really strict guidelines and policy around when you're acting on behalf of a company or when you're acting personally. I think that you're one and the same person.
And you are. Somehow I've ended up following you on Facebook, actually. I believe we are Facebook friends.
We are indeed.
You share many, many views and comments. I wonder sometimes whether people might read them and associate them with the views of Telstra rather than the views of Mark Buttman.
I don't think that... Well, I'm going to be genuine to who I am, whether it be as the CMO of Telstra or as Mark Buttman, a private person. And so I would make those comments regardless, I think. So,
John Steadman.
Yeah, I think when you go on Facebook or any form of social media, it's in the public domain, and therefore you need to be relatively careful about what you're saying. And when you cross the boundaries, then you pay for it in the end. One thing I do hate, though, about blogs and people that speak to trade press and so on, is that I hate
There's
people...
There's nothing to hate about people who speak to trade press.
No, I just hate people that make comments on blogs or to trade press and use the word anonymous. To me, if you've got something to say, put your name against it. If you can't put your name against it, then don't say it.
Yeah, well said.
And on to you, Joe.
Unless the only people in your social sphere are your mum and your brothers and your sisters, there's no line. Yeah. So, you know, I recently had a conversation with a fellow CEO that had just got the job, and she had been just astounded that she'd she'd been on Facebook and Twitter for a long time, and when she got the big gig, all of a sudden there was this huge backlash, and it was... I think it really hit her that, oh, my God, my life in my social sphere is no longer mine. So I feel like there is no line. It is completely what you say. Joe, there is no private Joe Pollard unless I'm having a private conversation. So my advice to people is always there is no private and public. And I completely agree with Steady. I think in a world of blogging, particularly in the trade industry, there are too many people hiding behind anonymous saying disgusting things, that if we had a bit more, I put my name to something, then we would have a bit more open, good debate versus horrible cyber, like it's like cyberbullying in our industry. And I think it's appalling. I think everyone that anonymously puts their name to something should be, I just disagree with it.
Do you find that sometimes because of your professional persona, there are things that you think that you'd quite like to say that actually you choose not to put out there because of the role that you're in?
Yeah, I do. So I have a private part of my life that does not come into the public part of my life, and the private part of my life isn't necessarily exposed in a lot of social spaces. But then I'm a big user of LinkedIn. I love it, and that's the professional side, but that's just the way I deal with it. But I say to my guys, there is no line.
And Anthony?
At all.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with Joe. Of course there's no line. I mean, if you are going to post something in social media that you wouldn't want your clients or your employer to be aware of, then you're an idiot. I mean, I think it's just totally stupid. You are the same person. By all means, lead a double life, but do it very discreetly and don't publish it on Facebook. My advice would simply be, anything that you are going to put on Facebook that you've, if you're talking about our people, if you're going to put something on Facebook that you think that I might disapprove of, then don't do it, because it's not going to pay you any great dividend in the long term. So I suppose keep it professional when you're talking about your personal habits in social media.
So, Warlock, anything take your fancy?
Yeah, well, we've got quite a few here, but I thought one of the kind of interesting ones I found was, do you think consumers are aware of their impact on businesses? So if you're looking at Facebook, tweets, Foursquare, do you think they know how much we're listening?
Interesting. Again, that's probably one for the marketer to start off with. Do consumers know you're listening?
Yeah, well, we absolutely are listening, and we use various technologies to help us understand, hear conversations about our brands and about our businesses. So, I certainly think that they do, and through, again, I'll draw on my CBA experience more than Telstra, because I've not been there long enough, but we had a blogger outreach program that was very much responding to customers that were blogging about CBA, and we were able to handle a lot of customer service issues in that way. So I hope that they know that we're listening and that it's a good thing.
John Stedman, do you think the consumers realise?
Absolutely agree. I think clients and the industry listen to what the consumers are saying and react accordingly. And I think there's a number of cases around the world where someone said something bad about a product and the client has reacted accordingly on Facebook or whatever social media was being used by putting their point or case forward.
And do you think that the consumers realise that as well?
Do I think the consumers realise? I think so, on the whole. Yeah.
Joe?
I don't think we're there yet in Australia. I don't think we've seen, given that we're the biggest consumers of social media per capita, having lived in other parts of the world, I think there is a real understanding of clusters of people, the power that they can have en masse and in groups to make businesses and companies behave, or they can affect change. I don't think the Australian consumer has really exercised their power even a little bit. Because compared to the way you see social media and the power of social media with change in corporations in other parts of the world, I think we haven't faced a massive one yet. And I lived through lots in the US. So I think they think we're listening, but I don't think they en masse understand the power they could have. Hasn't been harnessed yet.
Anthony?
Look, I think that if the question is, do consumers realise that we're listening, I think it very much depends on perhaps the level of sophistication that they have in understanding the sorts of channels that we're referring to. I think that there's probably a kind of latent understanding that companies like Google can can observe how we use the internet. Whether they intricately understand how that might manifest and what the consequences might be will very much depend on the individual. If we're talking about people having an understanding of the power that they could wield as a collective, now I'm inclined to agree with Joe. I don't think people necessarily understand that. I think some people do. And I think also a lot of people might imagine that it's being listened to, but somehow or another it's like having the radio on whilst you're doing something else. It's not an active listening. And I think the evidence for that is that when you do see companies that listen and act, consumers react in very surprising ways. I've heard of experiences where airlines listen to customer comments about a flight being delayed and then actually do something in real time for that person that just made that negative comment. And people are astounded. And I think that I suppose, indicates that whilst there might be a sort of passive awareness of a conversation being listened to, they don't necessarily expect that anyone will do anything with that information.
Well, I don't think that we've had an example in Australia to the extreme that in the US, like Dell Hell or United Airlines with the guitar episode that ended up going all around the world. But
for people who don't know, that was the United Breaks Guitars video.
That's right. So those two things were phenomenal. And in Dell's case, they've taken that and turned it into a major success from a sales perspective by really embracing social media and using that as a sales channel. So, you know, we might not have had an example like that as pronounced as that, but I certainly think it's on the way.
Yeah.
Well, that was a good question from Twitter. Let's see whether the comment stream of Mumbrella can do as well. Have you got another one for us, Robin?
There's a question that suggests that people are leaving the marketing industry because it's an industry they're not proud to work in. The question is, do you think that marketing itself has an image problem?
That's definitely one for the chairman of the Communications Council, Anthony.
In a way, yes. I mean, I think that one of the things that I would love to see change is the appeal that this industry has to people who are recent graduates from university. I think that we need to accept that there are many people fighting for the best talent around, and we should be working much harder at promoting this industry as a great career path for people that are about to embark on that stage of their life. And we should also acknowledge that there are many other industries that court these people very, very hard and in a very seductive way. And I think we definitely should be working harder at trying to attract and retain people within the industry. I think that agencies should be having a more of a medium-term view in the way that they look at the future talent, and perhaps should be accepting that they should be taking more graduates, that they're prepared to invest more time and money in training, rather than thinking that the junior members of staff that they hire will be poached from someone else that's put that time and energy in. So I think that there is definitely an opportunity to be better at promoting the industry to people that are considering entering it. Whether or not it's kind of on the nose, you know, like secondhand car salesman type gags, look, I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think so. I don't think that the industry lacks credibility or is seen as I suppose, as something that is unethical. Whether or not in this country specifically, advertising or advertising agencies are seen in the same relatively high regard, I think, as perhaps they might be in the UK, I'm not sure. I mean, it all comes down to the culture of how advertising is consumed. But definitely we could be working harder to attract the best and the brightest when they're leaving university.
I'll come to John Steadman next on that one. And I suppose there's an additional question, Steady. I'd also add, media agencies themselves, do they just have a visibility problem that people before they join them maybe don't even understand what they do, yes, let alone have an image problem?
I absolutely agree. And to Anthony's point, I don't think we promote our business as well as we should. I think we should be seen more in universities promoting our business. I think one of the big issues this industry faces, and I'm, in fact, just read an article with one of your competitors, about
so
the fact...
I'm media neutral.
Of course you are, sorry. The fact is, I don't think our business trains as well as it should. I don't, because the Y generation in particular want training, they want development, they want career paths, and we as a business are not doing it as well as we should. In fact, I think I read something, or actually wrote it in the article, that in the States, baristas get more training than advertising people do in the States. And that says a lot about the business ourselves, that we are not training people to the extent that we should be. And as I said, the Y generation want training.
Joe, and this is obviously an issue that goes beyond advertising to the media industry as well.
I think the digital industry doesn't... I mean, I just look at it from the industry that I'm in now. We spend a lot of time... We have a program that we... our community service program at 9MSN spends... we do volunteer work at underprivileged schools. And what's interesting and what's heartening is that when you sort of... 9MSN goes in to some of these schools, we do mentoring programs, and you know, there's other accounting companies and finance companies and telcos, and their eyes light up when you're like, oh my god, you know, you're part of like the digital industry, and you know, you're... So I feel like we have a generation of people that are really excited about coming into our, you know, the digital space. But I agree with Steady, it's we have to commit to training them, because I think, you know, when I look at when I first started in media, there were, you know, a couple of television stations and you had to buy Cocoa Pops from 4 to 5.
There were three, Joe, not two.
Three, yeah. For $32, and you tried to get it for 31, you know. So it's just a lot more complex than it was starting out, and I think we have to do a better job of training. But I feel like the digital industries doesn't have a bad perception at all.
And Mark Butman, do you think that the marketing industry does have an image problem?
Well, I think if people are leaving because they're not proud, they should leave, because you've got to be proud about what you do. So good on them if they're not. That being said, I think that in many organisations, marketing has been relegated to the colouring in department, and we've got to change that. And I think that there are many marketers who don't believe that that's the case, and certainly many CEOs who believe in the power and the importance of marketing. At Telstra, you know, David Thodey has very much set the agenda as we're going to be a leading sales and marketing organisation, and has put marketing at the centre of what we do. And from that perspective, there's an expectation that we're as commercially capable as anyone else in the business. And I think that's a very important thing, certainly from a client marketer point of view, is to make sure that we're not relegated to the colouring in people.
We probably have time for just one or two more questions. I saw a hand over there go up first of all. And again, if you wouldn't mind standing up and telling us who you are, please.
Liz Rao from RedApp. How do you get a client to buy a brave idea?
How do you get a client to buy a brave idea?
Give them one.
Now, there's a thought.
We'll take that from that. We'll let the camera pick you up, Mark, and then we'll let you take that one again.
Sorry?
Say that again.
Oh, give them one.
Simple as that. John Steadman.
I agree. If you can't sell it to a client, then it's not a good idea.
And Joe.
I have a mantra when we're talking about how to sell something. It's how do you think about whether or not this idea is going to make the client look good, feel good, make money or save money? And when you think about why someone ultimately buys something from you, it's one of those four things or a combination of them. So I always say to my guys, which one of those or combinations are they? And round your pitch around that. And when I say look good, that doesn't mean, you know, are you making the person look good? Like, is it something that will be good for their business? Is it going to save the money? Is it more efficient? Is it going to make the money? Is it going to grow sales? So tailor your pitch around what is the benefit to them. And it sometimes it would qual, quant, but too often we just walk in and I've got to sell you something. I say to my guys every single day. If you have not revised your sales pitch for that agency or that client, you should be shot. Because if you have presented the same thing, you are a failed salesperson. So I want to see a new pitch done every time, because client A is going to want something completely different to client B, so why should the same solution work for both? So I don't think sitting on this side of the fence, we spend enough time going, well, what is it that's going to make them say yes and tailor it to you, versus we're just too generic.
Anthony, how do you sell a brave idea to your clients?
I don't think we're in the business of selling ideas. I think that we are in a business of creating a good understanding of who we are talking to and what we need to say to influence or change their behaviour or attitude. And I think if we get the foundation, essentially the strategic thinking right, then I think it gives us a lot more creative freedom around how we might express that message. So if you've got a client that already understands the strategic underpinning of whatever the campaign is going to be, and we're all agreed on that, and we all understand that, and you can show how the creative idea, brave as it may be, absolutely embodies that strategic point of view, then a client should be quite willing to buy it, because a more creative expression of that is far more likely to elicit a response or create talkability beyond the media dollars that are put behind it than a boring version of it. So we shouldn't need to sell anything. We should simply be able to go through a process that creates absolute clarity around what it is we're trying to achieve and then shows the logical link between the creative expression of that. And I think that would be the way we do it.
Tim, apart from my flippant response, I think the other factor of it is in building trust with your client.
Yeah.
And clients who trust their agencies to bring them great ideas and bring them solutions will have a much better shot at selling them big, brave ideas.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that actually, in my experience, the best work that an agency does for a client is in the latter year. So it's not in year one. It might not even be in year two. It would be in year three, in year four. And I remember many times where people would say, oh, you know, you guys are so lucky because you've got these clients and they'll buy any old crazy work. And you say, well, actually, no, we've spent years building trust. So and also doing the sort of stuff that I talked about before where people understood that what we might be doing executionally had some risk attached to it, was maybe considered brave, but there was a very strong and rational underpinning and a long period of trust that had been gained for us to be able to do that work. And fortunately, in many cases, good work does pay dividends, and also good work begets good work. So, it is somewhat self-fulfilling.
So the question to the panel, and be as brief as you want to be. Ahead of the Battle of the Media final, if you could live with any medium, and it doesn't have to be the ones that are in the final, for the rest of your life, just one medium, what would it be and why?
So I have to say the tea box.
Do you know, the panel has been quite good about not selling up to this point.
Is this as a consumer or as an advertiser?
For you as an individual, I think we've established there's no difference between the two.
Well, no, I mean, are you asking me if I could only read a newspaper or watch TV or surf the net
as a person? Yes.
Look, I don't want to be called on this because we do have a client that is responsible for the promotion of commercial TV, but I would say TV. I mean, I think that TV is still the most immersive way of being entertained. I think you have the power of colour and movement and sound and all of that stuff, and I think that the power of film in terms of entertaining and educating still remains for me a very potent force. And I think that as TV advances, the technology that is currently considered to be synonymous with digital media, the difference between digital and TV, I think increasingly converges, and all that kind of participative stuff that we currently now say is online, I think, will definitely be part of TV. So that would be my answer.
Jo?
This isn't because I work in it. The internet. Because in a world in the future, I'm going to be able to get all my television, all my movies, connect with my friends, find all of my information, read my newspaper, everything will be able to, it will be sourced there. So, you know, I still read a lot of newspapers. I just don't do it on paper. So everything that you're going to be able to get from every other medium is available on the internet. So,
and steady.
You stole my answer, Joe, but right. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Online, you can get everything.
Anything.
So, everything's converging into it anyway. So,
well, that's the go. That's just about where we have to leave it for question time. Just a few thank yous for me. Thank you to our keynote sponsor, Square Holes. Thank you to Viacor and Staging Connections, our streaming partners. Unfortunately, we didn't get as much time with any of our speakers as we would have loved to have done. So please thank again very much Mark Buckman, John Steadman, Joe Pollard, and Anthony Friedman.